It's become a North American cultural custom to take one look at that TV on the radio fan, that dutiful pitchfork reader, that twee aficionado that some of us are tempted to punch 5 times in the face, but nevertheless hold him up as the unwavering bastion of everything that is good and punk and trendy and hygienically sound and post-pedicure and sure as hell not vanilla in our world. Thankfully, Carl Wilson has adopted an altogether different standard to take the pomp and circumstance out of the insufferable criteria that we all know and love today. Still, the following conversation became extremely punchy, and still, there's something a bit dodgy, isn't there, about all this goddamn hipster taxonomy that's hurting culture, that's turning us all into an unthinking demographic, and that is causing us to conceive of violence, quite justifiably, towards equally insufferable record store clerks. Oh, there's no way to win! We're all just a bunch of sheep! How can we possibly win against the culture wars? Carl Wilson, can you save us? Please, can you save us?
Okay, so I am here with Carl Wilson, who is most recently the author of Let's Talk About Love. Carl, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
First off, I want to ask basically a starting question. If Celine Dion music is incompatible to your tastes, why bother to plunge into the listening in the first place? I mean, you indicate in this book that it was Madonna who was to blame for your experiment, in large part because Celine defeated Elliott Smith for the best song at the Oscars. I'm wondering, though, if this is a case of spending your energies on something. I mean, why bother to do that if it's someone who you despise initially? I mean, in this case, we can go into how you came to love Celine Dion a little bit, but let's start with this.
Well, I mean, it was specifically because I despised it. You know, after sort of having worked as a music critic for about 10 years, more and more I was beginning to question what the ground of authority one uses as a critic is. And, you know, in a literary sphere, very often it's kind of founded on one's comprehension and grounding in a canon or something like that people sort of use as their objective correlative in some way. But, you know, and you could question it on that level as well. And, you know, again, a lot of academic energy has kind of been put into that questioning of canonical knowledge. And I felt that in pop music over the past 30 years, gradually there's emerged that same kind of general consensus kind of wisdom among the people who use kind of critical writing and that critical discussion as their kind of grounding. And it seemed to me like it was ripe for the same kind of questioning. And it seemed to me like the best way to go at that, the best way to sort of test whether we really have something solid that we can use as a way to measure our musical appreciation, was on a personal level to go at something that I felt sure was dismissible and really question whether it was.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of taking a very personal dislike and testing whether it sort of stood its ground or not.
Well, you quote Paul Valéry's line that tastes are composed of 1,000 distastes, and going back to the issue of Madonna and Elliott Smith and the Oscars, I have to ask you, it seems to me that your assumption, the assumption that you're questioning, is more predicated on disliking something as opposed to liking something, and not everybody views art or the taste of art in that particular way. I mean, I think it's a little perhaps facile, I suppose.
Well, I mean, it was a deliberate kind of reversal. Like, we all assume that the central part of our taste is what we like, and that we've sort of gradually over time discerningly sifted through everything that's available in the culture and assembled a set of tastes. And among people who like the things that are somehow sanctioned intellectually to like, we agree that there can be disagreements. You know, you may like TV on the radio more, and I might be more into the Art Ensemble of Chicago, and we can agree that our interests might not totally coincide, but yeah, that we can respect that because they're within the sphere of sanctioned things. But I think the part that we overlook is the stage at which, and particularly people who in one way or another see themselves as kind of alternative culture people, that there's a point where an agreement is made about a large number of things being kind of trashy at the same time. And I think that that moment when you decide that you're on the side of people who have dismissed all the trash is kind of passing through a doorway in some ways. And then all the agreements and disagreements after that seem trivial by comparison. Yeah. Like that big decision gets made. And so, and in some ways, everything that you judge after that is judged on relative terms to its distance from the things that you've decided are dismissible.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so returning to that sort of central question of what, when you decided to dismiss things, and to me, that's a very teenage kind of moment, and that's, I think those, that's kind of the roots of it. And so the distastes and the sort of rankings seem to me to kind of build up from a floor that you set.
But you're assuming, you know, however, with this, that the tastes are based on either or. You are either mainstream or you are this alternative loving type of artistic appreciator. I, as a person who has variegated interests, immediately demolish such dichotomies. I have to go ahead and point out that even in your case studies in this book, you actually sought out various Celine Dion fans, and they came from all sorts of different backgrounds. The music itself made them happy. They didn't fall into any predicated income bracket or demographic, and we can go into that later. But what of this? I mean, I don't know why a dichotomy should matter so much if it's really about individual taste in the end.
Well, I think there's two things. One is that breakdown of that dichotomy seems to me a little fresh. You know, it's kind of this, you know, we're now in this period where a certain amount of cachet is attached to itself to being able to sort of have this high-low kind of combination in your sensibility. And that's a complicated thing in and of itself, I think. And I couldn't wholly treat it in the framework of this book, but I think it remains to be talked about in a lot of ways. It's like, okay, is that breakdown of the high-low distinction a revolution where we're all just enlightened now? Or is there some way in which it's still kind of serving an elitist agenda? Mm-hmm. Is there a way of being high-low that's important and another way of being high-low that's not sanctioned? You know, that's, I think that's one of the questions. But yeah, no, definitely. And certainly I think the book is addressing itself to some degree to a dichotomy that's in the process of breaking down. Mm-hmm. But I still think that if you get out there and talk to actual music fans, you'll find that a sort of snobbery is still very, very prevalent. Like, it's definitely been questioned, and it's changing some, but you'd be surprised how many people...
I go into indie record stores and I see this kind of nonsense all the time, and I essentially disregard it. But the same might be also said of fandom. Sometimes fans can likewise be very defensive about their particular interests and just as bad as the snobs. In fact, there's perhaps an anti-snobbery into effect. So I think that it cuts along similar lines.
Although
so
the anti-snobbery, in my experience, has a very different tone. Like, the anti-snobbery is... comes with a certain woundedness to it, I think.
Yeah.
I would not say the snobbery comes with that woundedness. And so there's a suggestion of a power dynamic underneath that, even though both camps may hold each other in disregard. I think there's one that is defensive and one that's aggressive, you know, and that difference still seems important.
So you're saying that the remnants of this dichotomy that are in the process, possibly right now, of being broken down, have much to do with this idea of a power structure, that you think it's all predicated upon, the cultural elite, or what remains of the cultural elite, are essentially the people who are on Pitchfork, writing for Pitchfork,
kind of thing? Or? Yeah, I think there's a socioeconomic and educational dimension to all of this, and you know, you won't... I think it's pretty consistent. There are people who, without those advantages, find their way to some kind of counterculture, but at this point they seem maybe increasingly rare. And that's, to me, the subtext of that whole question of cultural snobbery, you know, which in itself maybe is a more or less trivial problem.
Yeah.
Becomes a little more serious if you think, oh, this actually reflects social power structures, and it's a way in which cultural experience comes in to reinforce those divisions and to sort of undergird them without us even knowing that we're necessarily talking about social power and money and things like that at that time. And so part of the whole point of questioning all of this for me has been to say, in a period where there's an increasing gap between rich and poor and a shrinking middle class and all of these kinds of things, that maybe it's more important that we find a way not to use culture as a supporting structure to do that.
But I should respond to this notion of power structure by bringing up the example of Fiona Apple's Extraordinary Machine. It was a rather extraordinary scenario in which fans and highfalutin types came together and demanded to the record company, you must release the album that Fiona Apple intended. It was a rather amazing thing. It was something that was entirely unprecedented. It would lead me to believe that, well, maybe this power structure that you believe still exists in some form, perhaps is not so much there.
Well, I mean, I think that the sort of corporate control of cultural structure has definitely been challenged sort of in the internet age, right? And in the music industry more than anywhere. It seems increasingly plausible that the sort of combine of musical interests that have controlled the past 40, 50 years of music history are not going to be here in this form very soon. And there has been, and I guess I'm a little cynical about whether in a period of transition, you see sort of a democratization, but I'm not sure whether I really believe that that's what you'll probably get in the end.
You're still holding the Elliot Smith apple, the chip on your soul.
No, I mean, I just think that, like, power and money will rearrange itself and in some way, and, I'm not sure we get to sort of the cooperative utopia of a music industry in the end. But we're definitely in a period when fans have more power. But again, it's fans who have broadband access. it's not happening through some kind of like grassroots community movement. It's happening with people again with a certain amount of cultural capital to spend. And it's great that fans are having more sway right now, but I'm not sure that changes. I'm not sure that says that our society has rearranged itself in its.
Let's bring Immanuel Kant into this conversation, because of course he's brought up into the conversation in your book. You quibble with his notion of common sense, which is in his Critique of Judgment, in large part because he was concerned with ideal conditions. But inarguably, what we're talking about here, the internet, is changing the notion of these ideal conditions being in the presence or the control of a privileged class. Suddenly, the great utopian idea that Kant had, that he applied to those who had money and who had leisure time, now applies to everybody, because anybody can go on the internet and they can go ahead and listen to music, they can find things to listen to. So I'm not so certain if this is necessarily a bad idea. Maybe Kant's ideal took just a few centuries for technology to catch up with it.
Well, possibly so. I mean, but in that case, you might see, as we are seeing, that the consensus turns out to be something very different. Like, Kant believed that the consensus among educated men was what you would use to sort of establish an objective ground for taste. And, and as I say in the book, the suspicious thing about that is that, the people that he was looking for consensus among seemed to be people like very much like himself. So the objectivity of that is in question. But so yeah, maybe we can use the internet as a more ideal version of how you establish that consensus. But the very thing that's conspicuous about the internet is there is no consensus that gets established by the internet, right? The fracturedness and nicheness of culture becomes really, really visible on the internet, and so in some ways it seems like if we do take that as an ideal condition for Kant, then it turns out that rather than establishing a canon, what the consensus of people under ideal condition do is demolish canons.
But look at the Beatles and Elvis. I mean, this would seem to me to confirm the ideal conditions. It would be very difficult to find someone who is a music lover who hates the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or Elvis. I mean, there's a fairly common consensus, even if you don't love them, you could at least appreciate the achievement of these bands that just went and also likewise captured the popular consensus. And this is a little bit different from Celine Dion, in which there's a artistic criteria likewise being applied. So how do you separate this?
I mean, it's different than Celine Dion, and it's different than Stockhausen, right? So each, look at them as poles of a spectrum, and the Beatles and Elvis as being somewhere in the center of that spectrum. And by the end of the book, there's sort of a whole essay at the end of the book about taste and different ways of thinking about it and criticism. And the thing that at the end of this whole process of kind of immersing myself in a different taste world than my own was that I felt like where those big aesthetic disagreements arise, my tendency at this point is to suspect that really it's a problem of terms, that people are arguing on a different set of assumptions than one another, but that their conclusions perhaps are equally valid. But that doesn't mean that I think now that Celine Dion and the Beatles are equals. Mm-hmm. And it would be a whole other sort of chapter of this exploration to figure out where to find some kind of more objective set of measurements for greatness. But if you're kind of using populism and anti-populism hand in hand, what you do find is that people like Elvis and the Beatles and Louis Armstrong and Ray Charles, you know, they kind of win all of those contests.
Yeah.
And so like, I'm not saying everything's the same.
Well, then, but I then think what that, I just for the think aberrative, like, impulse with Celine Dion then? I mean, you know,
I think that there are things that are confirmed both by kind of elite opinion and populist opinion, and in those cases it's kind of good to think, oh well, you know, whatever direction you come from, this gets through the gates. But what explains what doesn't get through one set of gates and what doesn't get through another set of gates?
Yeah.
And so the book is more concerned with aesthetic disagreement than with agreement.
Yeah.
And it's the question of when we have these fights, you know, when you're at a party and somebody's saying this is great and you're saying this is terrible and you're having that kind of, you know, what are you really talking about? And my suspicion is you're talking about something that has a more deeply kind of autobiographical root than it does have any connection to some objective set of markers. But that's not to say that there might not be works of art that are more profound and universal than others.
But see, Carl, this is where I'm going to have to disagree with you, because you're applying a criteria here where if I go to a party to express a particular opinion about music, I'm immediately going to focus in on Celine Dion and absolutely damn her to the skies. When in fact, in my case, I actually have not even thought about Celine Dion in any serious capacity until I read your book. I mean, I've largely ignored her. So this is why I'm a little sort of suspicious. I mean, I hear where you're coming from, but I'm a little suspicious of how you're applying such a broad brush to how we have tastes and how we express these tastes.
Well, I mean, it might just be that Celine's not the best example for you, but maybe Whitney Houston is a good example for you, or maybe, you know, I mean, I think there's a whole category.
I ignore her too.
But that just, to me, speaks to maybe the aesthetic world that you live in is well cordoned off enough from places where you might have to deal with that. But I mean, the places that I've sort of used as examples in setting this up is sort of just in the media, the sort of people who are the representatives of our tribe, the aesthetes, which, you know, are sort of middlebrow aesthetes in terms of who's writing a column in the newspaper. Celine is a very favorite kind of whipping boy.
Whipping boy, huh?
Yeah.
You looked at her lately?
But, you know, so is Mariah, or so is Whitney, or so, like, there's a whole sort of category.
Whipping,
you know,
non-gender.
Yeah. There's a whole category of people that get trotted out to prove the kind of vacuity of mass culture. And Celine, I chose because as a Canadian and as someone who used to live in Quebec, she had a particular personal resonance to me. But I hope that the argument of the book doesn't depend so much on how you feel about Celine Dion in particular.
Yeah. That's the danger, I think, of your proposition.
Case.
Well, let's also talk on a totally different criteria that you put on. Let's go back to Elliott Smith. Why not? You observed that Elliott Smith defended Celine Dion after she was very nice to him at the Oscars. But why should this be a criteria if we're talking about the music? We're talking about the artistic quality. You have to separate, for example, Celine Dion the person from Celine Dion the artist. And I don't think it's entirely fair to go ahead and point this to some sort of revolutionary impulse or some distinction. I mean, look, we all know that behind every piece of art, good or bad, there is a human being, there is someone with feelings. But nonetheless, the art itself, you can take it or leave it. So what of this?
Well, I mean, the point of that anecdote in the book is that while we know that there's a human being behind every work of art, and if we stop and think about it, we may think there's a difference between the artist and the person, and that disliking someone's art may not be a reason to think that we dislike them as a person. Most of the time, I don't think it works that way. I think most of the time, when we do dislike something culturally, we start to glom a bunch of assumptions about the human being behind it and the human beings who like it onto that. And the fact that it's so easy for a personal connection, a personal meeting, to undermine your assumptions. And I think, you know, we've all had this, I think, that, you know, you meet somebody whose work you maybe are not a fan of, or whose opinions you maybe feel uncomfortable with, and then you meet them and you're like, oh, they're really nice, and like, suddenly your vituperative feelings about the things they say or do tend to be moderated by that experience. And to me, it's just interesting of the fact that we're able to have these vituperative feelings without imagining that moment of the real human being in the flesh. And we're able to sort of turn works of art or statements of opinion into kind of hyper-caricatures of themselves in order to kind of create this Manichaean world in our heads where there's the good guys and the bad guys culturally and politically and all of these kinds of things. And the fact that personal experience almost always tends to undermine that, it surprises me that we, in some ways, don't put that grain of salt in automatically, knowing that that is going to happen. So the way that sort of culture wars of one kind or another arise seems to me to have to do with being able to sort of socially segregate ourselves off from the people on the other side of cultural wars. And that to me is more the point of the Elliott Smith Celine Dion thing. It's not that his affection or respect for her for having been a kind person is in itself a whole justification for her music, but that it's that kind of edge of the wedge that suggests that the imaginary way we sort of set things up in camps might be easily kind of opened up and complicated.
Well, we could also get into the celebrity industrial complex. For example, the September 3rd, 2005 infamous appearance that Celine Dion made on Larry King. Personally speaking, that has no value for me whatsoever. It may be entertaining in some sense, but it neither confirms nor usurps my particular opinion of the music, because this is Celine Dion, the person. I mean, for all I care, you know, Celine Dion could, you know, molest small animals, and really it wouldn't have any particular bearing on how I feel about her music. So this leads me to believe that what you're talking about here, about the personal experience, it's almost made up for this kind of scenario in which Larry King has Celine Dion on his program so that he can ridicule her, so that he can make her look like a fool. I mean, because that's essentially what Larry King does with scenarios like this, and the look of shock and the questions and all that. I mean, here he was taking advantage of someone who, you know, may have been a little quirky about it, but we're going ahead and damning Celine Dion for being quirky as opposed to falling into this mainstream view that's, you know, appeals all across the globe, and that appeals in a rather mainstream capacity. It's almost like it's incompatible with the notion of someone or the artist behind that person being a little quirky or eccentric to begin with. So what of this? This is the odd dilemma here.
I mean, it's funny. I don't think of Larry King as being somebody who mocks his guests, actually. I kind of think of him as being sycophantic. So you're looking differently at this incident than I did. I sort of feel like he sort of set it up. He knew that Celine had an interest in New Orleans, and so when Katrina happened and she donated $1 million, you know, that's the kind of occasion that calls Larry King up, and he goes, somebody donated $1 million, that's, we'll have them on. and the fact that she was sort of in an unpolitically correct way so emotional and passionate about this, and, you know, almost that, you know, anybody who wasn't Celine Dion, who, like, had that level of passion of it, wouldn't be allowed on television.
Yeah.
You know, anybody who was going to sort of defend the looters, you know, if it was, you know, Henry Louis Gates, you know, we wouldn't be on Larry King doing that. And so it was a moment kind of breaking through, and just the fact that that Celine Dion in that moment indicated herself to be a slightly more complicated character than Larry King might have assumed she was, I think is what's kind of interesting about it. And I bring it up in the book because to me it's indicative of a bunch of things about her cultural context that are not immediately transparent in her sort of Quebecois origins.
Clearly didn't see, for example, the Mickey Rourke appearance, where he was on Larry King and there was a wrestler who was essentially, they were basically playing it up, and Larry King is sitting there saying, he's apologized, he's taking the high road. And it was the most ridiculous clip I think I've ever seen. Larry King does this over and over, so it actually, I guess the notion of ridicule, I should probably rephrase, it's feeding the celebrity culture beast, as opposed to having a sort of place for people to be who they are and to restrain one's judgment.
Yeah,
and
he encourages things to happen. You know, I mean, that's true. And the crazy thing about, so in the Celine clip, you know, she's ranting and crying and all this thing, and at the end of it, unbelievably jaw-droppingly, Larry King is like, is there anything you could sing
that
would express how you, and I'm just like, what? And, you know, and Celine being this very dutiful kind of person who feels like her show business job is her show business job, you know, that she's been doing since she was 11 years old, is like, okay, I'll sing something, you know, and it's just, it's amazing,
But it's also a pity to some degree, because you claim that this was both the one time where we had a real Celine Dion to see, and here she is, well, actually taking cues, as you point out.
Well,
I'm not certain if it's real.
Well, no, it's, I feel like we see the real Celine Dion for a couple of minutes there, and then she's asked to put the mask back on, and she does. And so you're seeing sort of both sides of her there.
Yeah.
You know, there's... And I think that this is something that her fans really appreciate about her, is that the part of her that's kind of awkward and off-putting is, like, this sincere person that can't help leaking through her, like, very willful and dutiful performance of what she understands herself to being asked to do. And I think people respect both sides of that. Mm-hmm. People feel like, oh, you work so hard and you're trying so hard to be good, you know, and you know, just the same way that, you know, I think people identify it with themselves in their personal lives. They're like, I'm trying to be a good daughter and a good mother and all these kinds of things. And yet, you know, you can see that there's a real person in all of that. And I think that, you know, that's an identification that a lot of people have with her. You know, sort of the global identification with her has somewhat to do with that.
The pro-Celine people do, but the anti-Celine people are actually leaving snotty comments on YouTube. They're ridiculing her, saying that she's completely crazy. And so again, this comes back to, I guess, reinforcing a particular idea of Celine Dion, predicated on a celebrity image, which may be real or quote real. I mean, you can get into Lacan
if you really want to.
but I don't know how this has anything really to do with how we perceive her music, or why. Maybe you can comment upon and tie this into, I guess, the perception of this cultural dichotomy as a whole. Why this matters so much to someone like Celine Dion?
Well, I mean, when you say that no piece of information you could get about an artist would affect your point of view, I'm skeptical. You know, I really think that we take a lot of cues from the cultural context around something. And
do you like Roman Polanski's films?
I love them. Sure, yeah.
Yeah, do you like Woody Allen's films?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you like Dostoevsky's novels?
Yeah, yeah.
All fantastic. All terrible human beings.
Yeah, no, to me it's not... The moral side of it is not what we're taking cues from. What we're taking cues from is the status side of it. If something is coming from a realm that we think of as abject, we're much less likely to embrace it, unless it's been passed through some kind of filters that kind of sanctify it on some level, whether critical or whatever it is. So it's more the associations that things have. And like, yeah, like, I mean, people who are Michael Jackson fans, largely, you know, maybe were queasy for a little while, yeah, until like that seemed far enough in the past that they could come back around to it and all that kind of thing. Like, I don't think it has to do with the moral actions that someone has taken. Although, you know, maybe Charlie Manson's music is better than we give it credit for.
I haven't listened to it. But Off the Wall, great album. I mean, you know, Michael Jackson being a pederast, not so hot.
Yeah.
I mean, but then again, there is a complete disparity between those two actions. And in fact, I would even argue that the celebrity culture that we're talking about only sustains the contemporary, the latest album in relation to the latest image. But for a while, actually, the last couple of years, I've been hearing a lot of Off the Wall and coffee bars and the like.
I think history really, because once something is historical, mm-hmm, it no longer has that much relevance to current social norms. And so then you can safely like anything that was considered trash 50 years ago and regarded as quaint and charming and all of these kinds of things. Like, then nobody is going to call you on the carpet for that because it's not relevant to...
Ah, so you're saying this applies more towards the contemporary view of Celine as opposed to, say, something that she did 20 years ago.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, I feel a little bit like this study. Ideally, I would have done this study earlier when she was still sort of more at the apex of her fame, and it maybe would have been, you know, maybe it should be a book about Nickelback or something, you know.
Always enough to get
It's just hard to move that fast culturally. And so inevitably you end up kind of doing something that maybe you can see its moment, mm-hmm, a little more clearly. But yeah, I think that there's like an expiry date of that kind of cultural scorn.
Interesting.
And after that, it gets to be reclaimed or not reclaimed. You know, it's kind of either reclaimed or forgotten, you know?
Well, with this in mind, there are two things that come to mind, because the Celine Dion fans who you talked with were talking about the Titanic song.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a song that shall not be named, but this is more than 10 years old now.
Yeah.
So therefore, it probably has an expiry date, so therefore it makes the terms of your experiment null and void somewhat.
Well, no, I mean...
Wait a minute here.
Well, it's a question. I mean, I think... I'm not sure the expiry date is quite that short, but, you know, I kind of tend to think 20 years is more where that kicks in. But the thing about, like, My Heart Will Go On is that it's still being played at weddings and funerals and, you know, baptisms, and, you know, it's still very much sort of in currency on that level all over the world. So, I don't think it's quite passed into history as yet.
Yeah. Well, then at the same time, you also write very openly about you going to a Celine Dion Vegas show. You also point out that this was roughly 6 months after you had left your wife. And I would argue, well, maybe this is a variable to your experiment that might affect the results. You found a particular feeling at this show that was entirely unexpected. But perhaps your frame of reference, your frame of emotional reference, may have, I suppose, polluted or sullied what you were attempting to do. So therefore, how could we take the experiment seriously with this in mind? Or
how do you
accuse yourself here? I'm really curious.
I think that... our relationships to music tend to have a pretty intense relationship with our emotional life as we go along. And so, you know, if it hadn't been my divorce, it could have been anything else that, you know, once you find yourself sort of being affected by something, it calls up personal experience. And that's sort of the sign that it's getting somewhere, right? I don't think I was sitting in the audience at Vegas like, two steps away from a nervous breakdown or anything, but that was the emotional context.
I wasn't implying that.
No, but that was the emotional context that was relevant at the time. And so I think if something was going to move me, it was going to make me think about those issues and that kind of thing. And that's really more the relevance. You know, to me, it's more, and you may say, you know, perhaps you were a little more vulnerable than usual, perhaps. But like, so are most people when they fall in love with a particular music. It's often, you know, the thing that musicians hear all the time, and you talk when you interview them, and say, like, the thing that matters to me is the people who say, this music got me through a tough time in my life, and it was important to me. You know? And so that's, I don't think that that's an invalid measure. I think that that's a relevant question in terms of what loving music is often about.
But this is interesting because these feelings in terms of self are fascinating because you go into great length about the idea of social community in relation to music. And I would counter-argue that, well, just as I went to Tools of Change recently, so I'm a little bit suspect of the idea of social being applied to any art as a whole, as a complete panacea. Because, you know, we all need time to ruminate upon something and to take something in, and the process is not necessarily social. Obviously, it's social if we want to proselytize about, hey, this is great, you should check it out, or, hey, this is bad, but, although I seem to be more of the, hey, this is great guy. But I think, are we possibly overstating the role of social community in establishing these terms of taste? I'm very stuck on this notion of individual taste, which I think is very important and actually kind of is the one thing that deflates the thesis of your book. But tell me.
Well, the thing to me is, I hope I say this clearly enough in the book, is that I also think that individual taste exists. And I think when you analyze sort of social category, you know, the sort of sociologists who've studied this stuff try to make the argument that it's entirely social. I don't think it is. I think that autobiographical experience is much more quirky than that. And we're not just the sum of our demographic categories. At the same time, I think that in the way we talk about culture publicly in North America, the social side of it is incredibly devalued. Yeah. And the book is more a plea to write that balance a little bit and acknowledge, you know, kind of put ego out of the way a little bit and admit that a lot of our taste is socially constructed. And we also have a role in it. And, you know, and what the percentages are, you know, there's no scientific way to test. But I think that we have a certain narcissism of taste in this culture that you can't really, in the end, back up without acknowledging that, of course, there's all kinds of social reasons why yes. taste operates. And I think just balancing those scales a little bit further would lead to taste being used a lot less as a weapon against one another.
Well, doesn't have to and be a weapon.
You know,
doesn't have to be yeah. a weapon. I mean, I think that this notion of social community, in fact, might very well be a weapon, as it was with Pierre Bourdieu and Distinction, which you bring up in this book. You write, to the extent we agree that coolness and lack of same are enormously influential, and that coolness is a social category, not a natural attribute, we are all Bourdieuvians. But this assumption rests, I would argue, on a big if. I mean, this assumes that we're all striving to be cool, that we're all striving to be social. And really, it's just speaking personally, I couldn't care less if I was cool or unhip. I just like what I like, and sometimes I meet people in certain substratas, friends and the like, and I share. But I'm not going to be offended if they love Celine Dion or if they're a religious zealot. If it makes them happy, that's fine. If we get along, that's fine.
Well, I mean, if that's the case with you, Ed, then good.
Yeah, I
but,
know.
You know, but see, I mean, I think that most people, if they ask themselves honestly, is it important to me to be cool, will like say, yeah, at least somewhat. You know, like, I think there is an anxiety around it that's very generalized. And like, especially in such a mediated culture where images of coolness are thrown at us all the time, and we're like very aware of what the sort of judgments are, and it is possible to walk away from that, although maybe, you know, and again, I don't know you well enough to know, you know, if that walking away can also be a pose that is like a way of being cool. but you know,
honestly, I mean,
sincerely, there are like a bunch of people who are able not to worry about that, but I don't think it's most people. I think most people do worry about that.
But Carl, you talked with the Celine Dion fans, and they said that they just liked the music. It was something that was very helpful to them during a particular time. It was never an issue of coolness or being judged.
But I think that, you know, Celine Dion fans are, as a group, one of the things that unites them is they're less worried about being cool than a lot of people are, you know, and that's kind of the point.
Ah, I see.
You know?
Okay. Well, fair enough.
And like, that's the thing that seemed like admirable to them compared to, you know, all of the sort of urban aesthetes that I know who, you know, are trying not to be so socially anxious and trying not to worry about status as much, but you still see, sort of see that anxiety a little bit in everyone. And then to sort of talk to these Celine Dion fans, that the degree to which they were refreshingly free of those kinds of anxieties was impressive to me.
But okay, but still, it can apply both ways. If I like the Mountain Goats, which happens to be hip, I'm not liking it because I'm hip. I'm liking it because, well, I think it's some interesting music. It's produced in very interesting, grungy circumstances, and it's a particular, I guess, aesthetic sensibility that works for me. And I discovered Mountain Goats entirely by accident, and this happens periodically, I think, with a lot of people.
Sure.
If you find out something like, oh, I didn't realize people were into this, or you think some band is like the biggest thing, or you don't understand why they're not the biggest thing. Like, for example, there's this great band I discovered in Leeds called The Lodger. I'm not sure if you've heard of them, but nobody in North America seems to know of them, and they rock.
I've seen the name. I haven't actually ever heard them.
I mean, yeah. And this is, again, one of those mysteries, and I listen to them, I think, oh, this has got to catch on, and it doesn't. So I don't know if the distinction of hipness that you're subscribing to, I guess, the alt music boosters is nearly as important as you're stating it to be. I mean, I certainly agree with you that snobbery in any form is certainly a poison, or certainly pernicious in some sense. But I'm not certain if, I mean, you know, if my particular stance that I'm conveying to you is any different from the Celine Dion fan who listens to the music and just really doesn't give a shit.
I mean, maybe not. I mean, again, I would never be presumptuous enough to say like, everyone suffers from these viruses. But I would say that I look around and I see them being pretty persistent. Mm-hmm. So the reason to make the argument publicly is to say this is still going on, and it's a social phenomenon that's fairly pervasive.
Uh-huh.
But you know, if you feel free of it, then congratulations. Although I would point out that like when you mention the Mountain Goats, you still mention the grungy circumstances under which it's produced, which to me is kind of a social signifier of its, you know, independence from, you
it's
know,
an aesthetic this, there's the still music, this, you know. It's an aesthetic. I mean, you know, they could be millionaires for all I know pretending to be grungy, but I like the particular sound
but
of
if
grungy.
They were millionaires pretending to be grungy, you don't feel like you would be affected by
no.
that information?
No.
Okay.
I mean, look, I'm a guy who...
I mean, I think a lot of people would... Their attachment to the authenticity that's kind of represented
well,
by that,
you,
you know, would be,
I can
you know, yeah.
What you're saying.
Well,
yeah.
I think that those like authenticity wars, and you know, I sort of stayed away from this in the book a little bit because I feel like it's much trod ground, but you know, that authenticity, notions of what constitutes authenticity, seem to me have a lot to do with these kinds of social struggles that I'm talking about, you know.
So we're really not talking about a dichotomy between class. We're actually really talking about authenticity, that this is the new struggle as the dichotomy breaks down.
I mean, I think that authenticity conflict often has to do with class on some levels. You know, your question of what keeping it real means has to do with, you know, not being, you know, like, why do we valorize the streets in this way? Or you know, our whole notion of sort of what's real having to do with the degree to which it's business motivated, and all of these things have, you know, class and political implications submerged in them, and that's kind of, you know, part of the point.
So one last question: would you say that taste is justified if one can apply an aesthetic criteria that looks at, say, for example, the streets versus the rich, and is willing to either love or hate it for the exact same reasons? Is that okay with you? Is that the solution to the Celine Dion scenario? Or
I think that it's more, it's more having an aesthetic that acknowledges its specificity to you,
mm-hmm.
and that taste becomes more interesting when we stand up for its subjectiveness. And that makes, and I think that potentially makes all of our conversations with each other more interesting. If like we're understood to be saying, you know, not I am right and you are wrong, but this is
I
my
feel
perspective
this way. Yeah.
and this
yeah.
is your perspective, and then you can disagree and like maybe get into an interesting
civil disagreement.
About
I'm
that.
With
yeah.
you here,
yeah,
man.
Exactly.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, Carl, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks
for your time.
Okay.